Hey, everybody. Welcome into another episode of Investing in Real Estate. I'm your host, Clayton Morris. And today's episode, I'm super excited to dive into more talk about apartment building investing. And for those of you who are new to this podcast, this is the podcast where we focus on buy and hold real estate for cash flow. These are properties that most of our guests, or at least I know I do, hold for the rest of our lives. And that's the purpose of this show, to create cash flow, legacy wealth, and financial freedom. And today's episode, I've got Michael Blank on the show. He's a full-time entrepreneur, he's an investor, and he's a coach who's passionate about helping others do their first apartment building deal and to get out of the rat race. I love that. And Michael joins us now on the show. Michael, great to have you here.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
So you, I think you maybe by a little bit of a hurricane alley down there. Are you down in Virginia? Is that right?
Yeah, it missed us. We're thankful for that.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So tell me, I'd love to hear a little bit about your story before we dive into some strategies and tactics to help people get to their first, you know, apartment building. How did you first get involved in real estate? Tell us a little bit about your backstory.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it took a while. It was, I was 35 before I actually took action. Number one, being an entrepreneur, but number two, really pursuing a passive income to get out of the rat race strategy. And so, you know, I was 35 when I read Rich Dad Poor Dad, and I was like, daggone it. You know, where was this book been all my life? You know, someone should have, you know, slapped me upside the head with it. And I was like, man, I got it all wrong. You know, I need to really build passive income. And so I needed to get into real estate. The first mistake I made was to wait too long to get started on that path. And then I got, you know, arguably the wrong real estate strategy. I knew it was real estate, and I flipped houses and made some good money on it. But you can't quit the rat race flipping houses. It's a leveraged time activity for sure, but you're not getting any residual income. There's really nothing passive about it. So I did get into real estate, but then I didn't quite pursue the right strategy to get me to my end goal. And so that's how I got into real estate. And it took me a while to figure out, you know what, I needed to get buy and hold specifically, but then, you know, within that category, how am I going to get to my goals? Was it with single family houses? Well, man, that was a lot of work, and I needed to probably 50 houses if I wanted, you know, a certain amount of income. And that's when I said, you know what, I got it all wrong. I really need to get into multifamily, and that's kind of what I did in 2011.
That's great. I hope our audience is listening to this, because while we're focused here on this show on buy and hold real estate investing, and there's obviously many different ways that you can slice that apple, so to speak. What Michael realized right away, though, was, look, you know, flipping houses, that's just another paycheck, right? It sounds great. And you watch all these flipping shows on TV and, oh, well, man, I can make $70,000, $80,000, $150,000. But at the end of the day, if you're not investing it, if you're not putting it back into the system to create cash flow, then it's just a paycheck at the end of the day, right?
That's exactly right. And like I said, sometimes you got to learn things kind of the hard way. But for me, that was my realization. And then when I really thought about, you know, if you're clear about your goals, and you guys are all about buying and holding real estate, which is fantastic. And so you're already a step ahead. But well, then I recognized, well, there's no residual. And then I was like, well, what do I really need per month to, you know, to retire? What is what I call my rat race number? And when I did the math, when I finally thought about it, did the math, I was like, man, I need way too many single family homes to get there. I was like, man, I'm not prepared to build a portfolio of 50 houses. I mean, it's going to, number one, take me forever. Number two, it's really a lot of work. So I'm like, what else can I do? And that's when I said, my gosh, multifamily is really where it's at. And so I knew that for a while, like in my head, I knew it. But I always dismissed it as an advanced strategy for several reasons. One is I felt I didn't have the money for it, which I didn't. And I felt like I needed to get single family house investing experience before I, you know, did the advanced strategy. And now I know, looking back, that both of those were myths. I was essentially lying to myself, and I was ignorant of certain facts about apartment buildings. And, you know, better late than never, but gosh, I wish someone would have told me that a little earlier on.
So what are – because I suffer from some of those myths as well. And what's been comfortable to me, and I, you know, it's been great for my portfolio, and I'm nearing my 50 – you know, my 50 houses personally. So it hasn't been an unattainable goal, but I know you're right. It'd be great if I could just get one property that answers, that does all that for me in one fell swoop. So take me through some of the myths that you think people suffer from when they look at apartment building investing, because I'm sure that a lot of our listeners suffer from that.
They do, and it's, it, because I'm into coaching, I listen, I, you know, I hear these objections a lot, and after hearing so many of them, I was like, man, you know, we all collectively had it all wrong. We think we know something about apartment building investing when actually we don't. We just can't help. You know, we're ignorant. We don't know about these things. So one of them, for example, is I need the experience. I feel like single family housing investing is a stepping stone to multifamily, and I thought so too. That's why I flipped a bunch of houses. And when I noticed when I finally got into multifamily, I still got the questions. Yeah, okay, Michael, that's great that you flipped 34 houses. Good for you. But how many multifamily have you done? And I'm like, well, none. But I flipped. He goes, yeah, but how many? It's different. You know, it's different. So I was getting these questions from brokers, from investors, and I felt like I was treated as a complete newbie, and it completely baffled me. I felt myself, I was kind of the intermediate advanced, you know, real estate investor, you know, and I got no credit for it whatsoever. So that's the first realization. I got no benefit for it. And then I realized that all that activity I've done really actually didn't directly apply to what I needed to know in multifamily. So it was a combination of both. And now looking back on it, that was actually, not only was it not a stepping stone, but it was a distraction. Okay. And that's the worst of it. It's the opportunity cost. Once you're clear about your goals, which let's say is retirement, you know what your rat race number is, and you know how many units you need to own. What's the most efficient way to get there? And for some people, it might be a single family portfolio, but for others, it may take too long. And one of the reasons, again, is experience. So that's the first myth. And the second one was that, you know, I need the money before I get into that. And let me flip a few of my houses. Let me beef up my savings and I'll get back into it. And the truth is, you know, very few people are going to have the money to get into multifamily. And it's not something they can do in the next year or two. And that the solution to that problem is to raise money. And when I first did this, I mean, when I started flipping houses, when I really started flipping houses, I didn't have any room on capital left. So I had two choices. I had, well, I don't do anything, or I try to raise it. So I kind of bumbled through and raised money. And it actually was easier than I thought, because it was, you know, secured against real estate, 6-month repayment, 12% interest. And it was actually easier than I thought, number one. And number two, this giant light bulb went off in my head when I realized, oh my gosh, if I could raise money, my ability to grow my portfolio is not limited by my own limited personal resources, but only by my ability to raise money. And that is amazing. And I tell my students all the time in my writing, is you got to learn the secret to raising money. And once you believe you can, and it's just a lot of times – people can't visualize the process, right? If I point out to you exactly, you know, the steps to go about raising money, and maybe, you know, there's the devils in the details, but if I show you what's possible and how to do it, you kind of go, oh, huh, okay, I can see myself doing that, where before I couldn't. And as a result, it was a limiting belief.
You know, a friend of mine texted me today a photo. He was reading the Bible this morning, and he texted me a photo of Ecclesiastes 11:4. And I'm not well versed in the Bible at all, you know. And I probably fooled around in confirmation when I was growing up when my sister and I were taking classes. But he sent me this quote, and I've saved it now on my desk. And it says, "He who observes the wind and waits for all conditions to be favorable will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap." And I love that. I don't get biblical verses sent to me often in text messages, but I thought, right, you know, this is the problem that so many people suffer from. They sit around and they wait till all the conditions are perfect to take action before they dive into it. And so you realize that, okay, if I don't have all the answers, but if I could raise the money, then that takes the onus off of my own limiting belief around money. And you know, for me, Michael, that was something I always suffered from growing up, and my listeners know that well. It's like that fear of money, right? That fear of lack. And so many people, I think, tie their own success to this thought that they can't, you know, they can or they cannot raise money. So how did you start when you made that paradigm shift and you thought, okay, I'm going to start to raise this money. I've got to do it. I've identified a property. How did you go out and start raising that money?
Well, first of all, I felt like I was kind of compelled to do it. Number one, it was 2009 when I really got into house flipping, and the market was so good. There were so many foreclosures on the market. This is now in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area. So many foreclosures, and the retail market was recovering rapidly from the recession. So there was this giant gap between what you can buy it at and what sell it at. And I'm a capitalist opportunist, I suppose. And I was like, man, I got to do something about this. But I didn't have any of my own capital. So I felt like, number one, I had to do it. And I think if you feel like you have to do something to get where you want, it motivates you. And I think you asked, how did I go about doing it? And there's very, very few people that should really, well, actually at the time, I don't even know if there's anybody that showed you how to raise money. So I kind of did it by myself and kind of figured it out. And there's certain things, you know, that I figured out. For example, you know, how to find the investors, what to say to them, how to conduct the first meeting, what to do afterwards, and then what's the whole process of getting them to closing? What are some of the SEC considerations? But before all those five things, there was one thing that I couldn't overcome, and this is the biggest limiting belief out there is the reality of, hey, you know what? All right, I got you, Mike. I'm going to raise money, but here's the problem. I'm going to go out and let's say I get lucky and I get some kind of multifamily under contract. Now, I don't have the time to raise the money. I only got 30, 45, 60 days to raise. It doesn't give me enough time. And the answer to that is, that's correct. You don't have the time. There's not enough time. On the other hand, okay, I don't have a contract, a building under contract, so I have nothing to go out with to start raising money. And that's also true. And then people just kind of throw up their hands and go, all right, I'm stuck. I'm done. I don't know what to do. And I give up. When in fact, I've discovered the secret to raising money. So here it is. Here's how we overcome this problem, because it really is a problem. And I use what I call the sample deal package. A sample deal package is an investor package, and everything about the sample the deal package is real, except for one thing. You don't actually have it under contract, right? So it's got real photos, real projections. The building actually exists, but the only thing that's not real is that you don't have it under contract. In other words, you're behaving as if. Now, you tell your investors that this you don't have it on a contract. You're not going to try to dupe them. But you say, look, I've created this deal package so you get a sense for the kind of deal that I'm looking for, that I'm going to do. And I want to just use this as a conversation piece to, you know, get you familiar with me, the kind of properties I'm doing, to answer your questions, address any kind of concerns, so that when I actually get a deal under contract, we're not covering some of the basic information about me, the deal, and your comfort with the investment. In other words, you do that up front. And so when you do this, when you follow this model, you actually get verbal financial commitments before you actually put your first deal under contract. And that's incredibly empowering for people because, number one, there's no pressure of, oh my gosh, I have this deal under contract. Now I got to raise money real quick. And also it gives you a lot of confidence. If you know you've got five investors, you know, each with $50,000, that you've got $250,000 already verbally committed. And it gives you confidence to actually put stuff on our contract. And so that's how we solve this chicken and the egg problem for raising money.
I love it. I love it. And when you were going to your individual investors, how are you breaking down the deal? I mean, how would you breaking down the structure of that private financing? 10 years with certain terms. How did you present that to them? How did you know what was correct to present to them?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's another example how single family house investing didn't lend itself to multifamily at all because it's so different. But in the single family house world, on the one hand, it was very simple. It was a promissory note secured on the deed of trust for the property. It was a 12% interest, and it came due in 6 months. And it was so simple that, you know, a good title company can handle the paperwork, and it was very well understood, very simple, and so that was that. Now, in the multifamily world, you can do with promissory notes, but it's not usual to do with promissory notes because of the nature of the beast. And what you do instead is you basically create an LLC for the building, and you have your investors in there who are then equity members of that. And for the equity, they invest a certain amount of money. Now, when you do that, you have certain kinds of SEC requirements that you have to abide by. For example, you have to issue a certain amount of disclosures, which is called a private placement memorandum. You have to give them a subscription agreement. Of course, there's the operating agreement, which governs the agreement between you and the investors and how decisions are made and how profits are split, et cetera. Now, the good news about that, it sounds more complicated than it is because your SEC attorney will handle both of those. You just have to have enough information to articulate that to the investors as well as to manage your attorney, but you don't have to know about all the details. In other words, these are the things that you can learn with a little bit of knowledge. As long as you can explain it to your investors and make them comfortable with it, then that's what you need to do.
So that sounds great. And I can totally see these differences here between single family home investing and, of course, getting the larger apartment complexes. You're right, because our title company, you know, it's very, very simple. We construct a lot of notes with our investors and so forth, and it's just something that they can do very quickly. It's interesting to see it broken down differently here. So thanks for that. When you go through that process, how long do you have to close the deal? And what happens if something goes wrong? You know, you mentioned not getting or having the money verbally lined up before you pull the trigger on that property. But I also know that earnest money is in play here. And are things different when it comes to commercial property about perhaps losing that earnest money if there's an issue?
Yeah, it's somewhat similar. The thing that's different is the due diligence period is more involved. So here's a general progression, and you asked about, you know, losing money, and we don't want to lose money, neither ours nor our investors. So here's a kind of general progression, and in general, the philosophy is defer spending money on a deal for as long as you can. In other words, there's a sequence of events that if you follow, you will minimize the money at risk. So, for example, when I say that, let's say you have a 3-week due diligence period on a multifamily, the first thing you do is you do everything that doesn't cost you money. So you review the documents, the financials, you make phone calls, you check this, you validate that. It doesn't cost you any money. And after you're done with that, let's say it takes a week or maybe two, and maybe you walk the property with your contractor, all these things don't cost you any money. And if you still like the deal at that point, then it's okay to start spending money. For example, the next thing I would do is I would do a property inspection, which costs you money. You don't want to do a property inspection in the first week because maybe you want to walk the property first with your general contractor. Maybe you want to look at the financials first. So you don't want to do that in the first or second week. You want to do it in the third week. And once you've done a property inspection, now you have the permission to start spending more money, which could be now retaining the attorney to start drafting the entity documents and the private placement memoranda, for example. You don't want to do that until you're like 99% sure that you're going to actually move forward with the deal. Now, the deposit, of course, is governed by the purchase contract, and that one you can terminate for really any reason during your due diligence period. So that's kind of protected as well. Now, the investors are protected because, well, the money is actually not even escrow yet. The money probably goes in escrow a few, you know, days or maybe a week before closing. So that money doesn't actually get there until you have essentially the green light to close.
And you talked about the due diligence. Let's dive into some of that now, analyzing a good deal. It's typically very simple for someone to look at a single family home and to see, you know, what the value of that home is based on, you know, after a house is renovated. So, for instance, in our neighborhoods, and I know you know this, I'm just painting the picture for my audience here, which is you have a single family home, maybe next door there's a house that is in dire need of rehab. Well, that's not a good comparable property, right? The house that is within a quarter mile or so and has been totally updated, et cetera, that's a good comparable. So you want to pull a couple of those comparables to see what the potential value is once the house has been rehabbed and finished and fixed up, et cetera. On duplexes, that can increase. I know that can be a little bit more difficult. I know in my experience, certain areas, it's kind of harder to find duplexes, or you're trying to really nail down that value. When you get up into those higher value points beyond, or I should say multiple families, so when you're getting past the four family, you move into commercial territory, and that's your specialty. So when you're analyzing these commercial deals, is it you don't care really at all what the property next door is doing, right? You really just care about the financials of that particular property, right?
That's exactly right, and that's one of the things I really like about commercial property in general. And for house flipping, as you know, it's all about the after repair value. When you're doing rental properties, it you know, a little less important because you're holding on to it. But you're right; it's definitely comps driven. And in commercial world, it's not comps driven, here's why I like about it. You can have two identical buildings right next to each other. One's worth $1 million, and the other one's worth $1.4 million. And why? Because the first one, produces less cash than the second one, right? So it's all about how much income the box produces. The more income the box produces, the more valuable it is, right? It makes a lot of sense. If I put a certain money in, the kind of return I'm going to get out of it, that drives the value of the deal. The more something produces, the more I'm willing to pay for it, and vice versa. Which means now, what this actually means for the investor is, I can actually go in and buy the box on the left, and I can fix the box so it produces the same amount of income as the box on the right, and then I can sell it or refinance at a higher valuation, which means now it puts me in control of the valuation of the building. And I can't do that with single family houses or even duplexes, because at the end of the day, no one really cares about how much income the rental produces. If it produces $200 more in this house versus the other house, it's still going to be comp stripping. And so I am very reliant on the market. Now, obviously I use that to my advantage when I'm flipping houses, but I can't really control the value of the real estate. And in commercial real estate, apartment building specifically, I can. So the model really is I can go in and I am perfectly happy to pay fair market value for that box on the left. I will pay a ridiculously low cap rate for it if I have to. But then I will go in and fix that thing, and maybe the rents are low or maybe requires some renovations or it's been mismanaged so the expenses are really high. I will fix that over the course of time, 2, 3, 4 years or whatever else. And then when I've done fixing it, all of a sudden the box is worth $400,000 more. And that's what I like about multifamily. It's the best way to build a passive income and long-term wealth.
I love it. So some of the value add, you mentioned 2, 3, 4 years it could take you to increase the value of that property. What are some of the things that you're doing to increase the value of that property?
Well, it depends a little bit on the situation. I mean, I look Sure. for, and I teach my students to look for what I call stable value add. So let's parse that. It says stable value add. Stable means that it's producing cash flow. It's not a distressed asset. So it's not like half empty or something like that. It's not the kind of asset where I have to go get a special loan for. So that's what stable means. But value add means that there's something I can do to it to increase the income, right? And so, again, it depends a little bit on the deal. But in general, some of the things that are obvious are low rents. And the low rents could be a result of a couple things. It could be an example of simply poor management. A lot of the smaller buildings or even medium-sized buildings are self-managed. And the owner, maybe he's had it for a while and he's just happy to keep tenants in there so he's not bothered with turnover. So he just keeps the rents where they are. Or there's renovations that are required. And over the years, no work was done. And so it's kind of eroded a little bit, and that cosmetic appeal has gone away and compared to some of the other properties in the neighborhood. So as a result, in order to get people to go in there, they would have to drop the price of the rent. So those are some of the examples of why rent could be low, and it's typically because of lack of repairs. So either lack of repairs or it's just it just doesn't look very cosmetically appealing. So that's a clear area. Go ahead.
No, that's great. That's great. I was just going to ask you this. Some of the stuff obviously it sounds advanced, but it's really not. I guess when you go through, your coaching and take someone from point A to point B, you can really develop some of these critical skills someone would need to get and develop into multifamily investing. What are some of the other critical skills if someone's sitting back thinking, this is something I want to do, what would you advise them?
So before we get to that question, let me just finish the other one. As you said, just these are skills you have to develop, and that's true. But at the other end, and it's the other thing I love about commercial real estate, is that you don't necessarily have to develop those skills yourself because a property manager is going to do it for you. So the trick is, again, you got to know enough to basically manage your manager, kind of like you manage your attorney or earlier on in the money raising process. You just have to know enough to manage the attorney and you manage the manager in this case, right? So the manager, good property managers, and I've had bad and good managers. And when you have a bad manager, it takes you a lot of time, way more time than it should, and you're not getting the results that you want. And so that's the sign of a bad manager. A good manager, on the other hand, is not only getting you the results, but it's taking you very little time. So if you have a property manager that specializes in value add or conversions or turnarounds, then it's very little that you need to actually do because you already have someone on your team who's done that before. And there are property managers who specialize in some and others. So it's, again, a little bit of a myth that, hey, I need to learn all these things. You don't actually. You just got to make sure you hire the right person or the right company to do that. So just want to close that loop on the management. And then your other question was, how to get started? Like, what are the steps?
Sure. How to get started, and also, what sort of critical skills you would need to start analyzing, diving in, if you want to. Where do you start with that?
Yes, I think the Gary Keller book, The One Thing. I just love it because it really the Gary Keller in a book says, what's the one thing you can do that makes everything else unnecessary or easier, right? And so if I apply that to apartment building investing, then that one skill or activity is going to be analyzing deals. And here's why I say that. Number one, so if you learn how to analyze deals, everything becomes easier or unnecessary after that. So here's what I mean by that. So number one is you analyze deals, you obviously become more knowledgeable, which means that you don't sound like a newbie anymore. The biggest problem with, you know, commercial real estate is it's easy to sound like a newbie, but it's also an easy problem to fix. But the problem is if you use the wrong words and brokers classify as a newbie, they don't return your phone calls. They ask you questions like, well, let me see proof of funds. Let me see a resume of all the deals you've done. When you get questions like that, it's a true sign that you sound like a newbie, and that will hold you back for months. Very difficult to overcome. But with a little bit of knowledge, you can overcome that. And one of the ways to do that is by learning how to analyze deals. When you know how to use the proper words and just basic things like NOI, cap rate, and you know these kinds of things, it number one, you don't sound like a newbie. Number two, obviously, in order to make offers, you got to be able to analyze deals, right? So being able to analyze deals allows you to make offers, right? It makes sense. Also, if you have the right technique to analyze deals, it takes you less time. And it's a numbers game with any real estate, right? And so if I can analyze a deal in less time, I can actually make more offers, right? So it actually helps me make more offers. And then the other thing it does is it increases my confidence. And this is, again, related to the first point, but it actually permeates through everything that you do. If your confidence is higher, you can see that your confidence is higher when the way that people react to you. If investors start gnawing their head, they don't ask you qualifying questions. That all comes from confidence, which comes from skill level. And all of that stems from your ability to analyze deals. So I tell students, look, the focus of the next 14 days or 21 days is really for you to analyze deals. And from that, many other things become either unnecessary, proof of funds, resume, that kind of things, or become a lot easier.
I love that. I threw down a challenge to my listeners a few weeks ago here on the podcast, and which was to go out and go to your first real estate investing meeting in your town. And I heard from so many people that wrote back to me saying they took action. They went to their very first meeting, and it was not as scary as they thought it would be.
How about that?
You know, they made great connections, and they learned a lot. And some people saw speakers that were speaking that night, and others just, you know, had a great beer with some different investors. And I just love that, you know, yeah, it's not that scary once you just start doing some of those things to take action. Yeah, it's so exciting. So before we let you go, where are you finding your deals? Where do you go? Do you call up a broker to find these deals, or is this something you can find on Craigslist?
Yeah, so there are multiple ways, as you know, to find real estate. And you know, there's teachers out there who teach all kinds of creative ideas, you know, probates and wholesaling and sending letters. And those are all good, you know. However, they're a complement to the number one way to find deals, which is brokers. Brokers make it their business, the good ones do, to know every single apartment building owner in town. And what they do is they send them postcards, they make phone calls, they take them to lunch. They want to be the first person they call when that person is ready to sell, right? So the good ones know what's going on, right? And they have relationships with these people. They might be able to even give you an off-market listing if they know exactly what you're looking for. They'll call up, you know, Sam down the road and say, you know, this guy has been ready to, I have a buyer for you, right? So the number one way to get deals is through brokers. And the best way to find the brokers is through LoopNet. Right, LoopNet.com is you know where some people say where all the commercial real estate is listed, you know, goes to die, right? Because it's hard to find a good deal on LoopNet. If it's there, it's been picked over by a bunch of people, which is true for the most part. But it's a fantastic way to find agents who are listing multifamily. And if you do smaller buildings, you know, you're going to get some residential agents. And the larger you go, the more commercial the brokers they are. And you basically take that, you create your search criteria, and then you create a list of brokers to reach out to, and then you start reaching out to them. You know, you create a spreadsheet, you track your activity, you send an email, you phone call, you set a lunch meeting. And you want to do it in a way, of course, after you've educated yourself. And so you don't appear like a newbie, but you build trust with them. And when they send you a deal, you're going to respond to them and give you their feedback. And over time, the deal flow will increase and your trust will build with these brokers. And over time, that's how you will get deals consistently. Now, if you do a direct mail campaign, well, you're going to get a deal off that every once in a while? Yes, sure. And, you know, go ahead and do that. But only do that once you feel like you've saturated the market, you know every single broker in town.
Right. Go for the low-hanging fruit first. They make it their job. Like, this is exactly what they do every day. They get up and they put on that golden jacket, right? And they put on their name tag and go out there and do it. That's wonderful. Well, before we let you go, Michael, I wanted to ask you to just give us a little tip about you wrote an ebook called The Secret to Raising Money to Buy Your First Apartment Building, and I'm going to have links to all of this in the show notes. So don't worry if you're driving right now. Just head on over to morrisinvest.com/episode104. That's Michael's episode. So everything will be there in the show notes page. But Michael, tell us about the book.
Yeah, it's an ebook called, as you said, The Secret to Raising Money to Buy Your First Apartment Building. And it really kind of goes in quite a bit more detail about the money raising process and especially the sample deal package. In fact, in the appendix is actually a sample deal package, so you can see exactly what that looks like. So I think it might be a fantastic first step to kind of address that first objection, that limiting belief about multifamily investing.
That's great. So again, it's a free ebook. So you've got to go over to the website. We'll have a link directly to it so people can download that and take care of that resource. That's a really fabulous tool that I would encourage all of our listeners to do and grab. So Michael, any sort of parting thoughts and wisdom here before we let you go?
Yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind is, you know, we're all here to essentially quit the rat race, retire with real estate. I mean, that's why we're all, you know, doing what we're doing. And I want everybody to be kind of be clear about their goals and then figure out the best strategy for them. If you decide that multifamily is the best for you, then here's the one thing for that, right? So if you want to succeed with apartment building investing so you can retire, what's the one thing in that realm, right? And that one thing is your first deal. And I see this over and over again with people who have made the transition from quitting their job to being successful in real estate and multifamily is that first deal. The progression I see is that the first deal is the hardest to do for a variety of different reasons. It's new, you haven't raised money yet, you don't have deal flow yet, you're starting from scratch. And sometimes that first deal can take a long time. It might take a year to do that first deal. But here's what happens, Clayton, is once that first deal is done, the second and third deal happen in rapid succession. And not only in rapid succession, but they go up in size. And I've noticed that with, you know, people I've interviewed in my podcast and my own students and other people, that is the pattern. And because of that, I focus my attention, what I'm good at, what my passion is helping people do their first deal. Because I know if I can get you to do your first deal, the rest, frankly, is history. And I will always push you to expand your comfort zone and do the biggest deal you can because you get your goals faster and there's actually efficiencies of doing a bigger deal. But if I can't do that for some reason, rather than you quitting the strategy, go out and buy a small one. Buy out a duplex or a fourplex. I don't care, okay, because even a duplex will get you to a 10 unit, a 20 unit, a 30 unit. It's just of where you start. So the biggest advice I have for you guys, if you're considering multifamily even remotely, is fine, educate yourself, you know, have your big dreams and whatever, but focus like a laser on that first deal.
My guest has been Michael Blank. We really appreciate you joining us. We're going to, again, have links to all of this in the show notes page. Just head on over to morrisinvest.com/episode104. We'll have links to Michael's website, his free ebook, and go there, take part, get educated, and get out there and start buying properties. Michael, it's been my pleasure to have you here on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for subscribing and downloading. I want you to go out there and take action and become a real estate investor. And if you're ready to take action today and you want to buy your first rental property or expand your portfolio, that's what my team does at Morris Invest. Visit us today at Morris Invest, that's my last name, morrisinvest.com, and click on the Book a Call tab. And we'll jump on the phone with you for 30 minutes and talk real estate and hear what your goals are and help you get your first rental property up and running. Much love to you all. Have a good one.